She immediately called for Suzuko to come and see, which she did, having the presence of mind to take a photograph before touching her coat. Then she went into the bathroom and found her umbrella had vanished. It turned up in the small yard outside the kitchen door, still open and surrounded by the family dog and her three little puppies, none of which had made a sound all night, even during the banging. Nothing else unusual happened, and Suzuko went straight to the office for another day's work. That night, it was my turn. I arrived in the early evening with her nanny Gimaris Andrade and his son Sergio, and we spent some time making a detailed drawing of the whole house and yard, photographing everything that had been damaged by fire, checking the wiring and the plumbing and having a general look round. Then we sat down to wait until 12:30, to see if Suzuko's experiences would be repeated. They were not, and her nanny and Sergio went home at 1:30, leaving me in the kitchen reading Frank Podmore and Poltergeists. Podmore, one of the ace investigators of the early days of psychical research, seemed to think they were all due to hallucination or trickery. No doubt he was right, I thought, as I finally turned in on the sofa at 3 a.m. too. I had a few mild heart attacks when the very noisy cuckoo clock above my head chirped the half hours, which showed me how much louder ordinary noises sound at night. It was no longer night but broad daylight, however, when Mother got up and went out for the bread and milk. This would have been about 5:15 and there were already traffic noises in the street. Just around 5:30, I decided nothing was going to happen, and drifted into that pleasant state in which you know you will drop off to sleep after all. Then it started. The timing was uncannily perfect. The banging had started the night before just as Suzuko was dozing off, and now the same thing had happened to me. But 5 hours later, somehow, I managed to switch on my tape recorder in time to record Irasi opening her bedroom door, coming halfway down the stairs and asking me if I had heard the bangs. Had I, indeed? They were not the kind of bangs anyone could sleep through. They had shaken the whole house. To me, they had seemed to come from the lighted passageway outside the two upstairs bedrooms, but Irasi later swore they sounded to her as if they had been made downstairs. I was unable to count them, but there must have been 5 or 6. Irasi went back to bed and I struggled to wake up properly. 1 minute later, 11 deafening bangs resounded again from upstairs. They sounded like someone thumping the wooden floor with a broom handle, although nothing vibrated and they seemed to echo more than they should. I checked that the recorder was working properly and that nobody had switched the batteries round during the night. Then, 3 minutes later there were 7 more bangs, followed almost at once by 8 hand claps, and at 5:40 no less than 15 shattering thuds as if somebody was not sure if they had already managed to attract attention. Each set of bangs sounded slightly different, though they all came from roughly the same direction. It struck me at the time that Nora could have made them herself, and later I discovered a heavy pair of shoes under her bed. At 6:02, Mother opened the door of Nora's room and spoke to her. She assured me later that Nora had taken a sleeping pill and had only just woken up. At once, the door was slammed violently in her face, almost hitting her. Tests I made later showed it was impossible to slam it so hard from the sitting position on the bed Nora swore she had been in at the time, and Mother agreed. If Nora was lying, this made Mother an accomplice, which I found a ridiculous hypothesis. That left only poor Irasi, and if the other two women were out to get her, why didn't they just kill her? It would have been far less trouble. It was about then that I was reminded of the Sherlock Holmes story, Silver Blaze, in which Holmes draws Watson's attention to the curious incident of the dog in the night. But, Watson had protested. The dog had done nothing. That, Holmes replied, had been the curious incident. Here too the dogs, all 4 of them, had done nothing. This was very curious, since they had made a tremendous racket on my first arrival. Dogs are supposed to be sensitive to ghosts, yet this useless lot had snored through at least 45 loud noises in the early morning without making a sound. Could it be that all they had scented, seen or heard, was somebody well known to them? Somebody like Nora? I was about to go to the bathroom when Nora came downstairs, and one stood aside to let her go first. She looked bleary-eyed and none too well. While she was in the bathroom, I noticed the two of the alphabet cards I had spread on the kitchen table had been moved. The A and the C had been switched, the former being turned face down. Nora could have done it on her way to the bathroom, though Mother had been near, with her back to the table, and doubted this to be possible without her noticing. Nora came out of the bathroom and I went in, to find my umbrella had moved from the shower rail where I had left it to a corner of the floor. Both women immediately assured me that they had not touched it. When I came back into the kitchen, two more cards, H and Y, had been turned over. The cards were on a rather sticky oilcloth, and flipping them over as one passed was not at all easy, as I found by experiment. We had coffee and rolls, sitting away from the table at my request. I explained to the women that one could sometimes make contact with poltergeists by talking to them, or even thinking to them as Sir William Barrett had once managed to do, getting certain numbers of knocks in reply. 3. While we were discussing this and generally moving around the kitchen, the letter D turned itself over. Had I not taken several photos of the cards, I would never have noticed this, for at one point Mother opened the yard door to give the dogs their breakfast, whereupon they all rushed into the house to have a sniff at me. In the ensuing confusion, with three people trying to catch four lively dogs, Irasi was still upstairs. The letter D fell to the floor, though this might well have been done by Mother Dog's front paw looking for a piece of bread. Suzuko arrived at 9 a.m. as planned. It was Saturday. We spent an hour recording deliberate hand claps and bangs on Nora's bedroom floor, made with a broom handle by everyone in the house in turn, including ourselves. They all cooperated willingly, Nora proving by far the weakest thumper. Then we had them all do hand claps, and again Nora's were extremely feeble. Even I, an experienced concertgoer, was unable to make noises anything like as loud as those on the tape. While we were all banging away, I noticed that several objects in the living room vibrated, whereas I had noticed earlier that they had not done so when it was the poltergeist doing the banging. We hoped that it would be possible to study our tapes to see if there was any difference in the acoustic patterns of our normal raps and those made by the poltergeist, which sounded much the same to us apart from this difference in the vibrations, or lack of them, that accompanied them. Many years later, this was finally done, with intriguing results. They may have sounded similar, but on chart paper they did not look at all similar. 4. I went home for a good day's sleep, and Suzuko took the next night watch. She arrived at 5 to 10, finding Irasi and her fiancé downstairs watching TV, while Mother and Nora were already in bed. Almost at once there were 4 or 5 raps from upstairs, and Suzuko dashed up into the front bedroom, finding both women already installed in Nora's double bed. Her husband was still traveling, and in fact I never met him, but still awake. This again established that if Nora was making the effects, Mother was an accomplice. There was another single outburst of raps just after 1 a.m., but otherwise it was an uneventful night, except for the fact that cards B and T were found turned over in the morning. On my second night watch, I was given a display of furniture moving. After a quiet evening, I got off to sleep at about 3, and woke up just after 7 as Irasi let herself out of the front door to go off to work. As soon as her friend's car had accelerated out of hearing, I heard a loud series of bumps, and a small upholstered footstool came bouncing down the stairs into the room where I was still lying on the sofa, though wide awake. Grabbing my camera, I was fiddling with the light meter when Nora appeared on the staircase asking what had happened. I asked her not to touch the stool, and she went back into her bedroom. Had she opened the door of the back bedroom, where the stool had been kept on top of the wardrobe, the sunlight would have lit up the hall, stairs and part of the living room. That footstool had been thrown through a closed door. Less than a minute later there was a loud crash in the yard. Mother gave a startled cry and exclaimed that it was going to be one of those days. Out in the yard we found a heavy drawer full of clothes from the back bedroom had flown out of the window and landed all over the dogs. Even this had not made them bark. Several other objects had ended up in the yard during the previous months, and I suppose dogs can get used to anything in time. I managed to record this noise on tape, and going over it later I decided that for Nora to have thrown the drawer would have called for an impossible degree of speed, timing and subterfuge, for after the second crash she immediately came out of her own room again to see what was going on. The following night, Suzuko slept in Nora's bed, at Nora's own request. There were no bumps, and the furniture stayed where it was, but in the morning, Suzuko was lying in bed wide awake when Mother came in to get something from a drawer. Suddenly, Nora's pillow shot from under her head, passed over Suzuko's, and landed on top of her tape recorder on the floor. Nora had made no movement at all, but immediately woke up and asked where her pillow was. Later, we made tests with the light foam pillow and found it could be flipped quite a distance with one hand, but not without making an easily noticeable movement. Things quietened down after that, and the only strange occurrence for the next four nights was the appearance of a broken soapstone doorknob, which fell to the floor of the upstairs hall early one morning, only seconds after Suzuko had silently removed the thread she had fixed to Nora's bedroom door, the other end being tied to a small bell hanging down in the living room. Nobody could recall ever having seen such an object, and the knob is now in the IBPP's rapidly growing collection of poltergeist souvenirs. This includes several items of burned clothing and almost all the objects transported during the Paraguay affair, except the Jeep. On my next visit, I took a chance, and told Nora outright that I thought she was responsible for the phenomena, all of them. I did not suggest she was doing them on purpose, but that she was being controlled by a spirit and being made to do them in a state of instantaneous dissociation or trance. This was a lot of nonsense, or so I thought at the time, but it seemed the only way to make it clear that Nora was to be watched without offending her and losing the family's confidence. Nora took the suggestion quite calmly, and Irasi agreed to keep a special eye on her whenever there was a happening in the future. Both Irasi and Mother assured me that several phenomena had taken place in the past when Nora had been out of the house, and indeed the most serious incident of all had happened when the house had been entirely empty. This had been the outbreak of fire inside the closed wardrobe which had destroyed a great deal of Irasi's clothing, and had the family not returned in time to put it out, the whole house might well have gone up in flames. The thing certainly knew all the tricks. All seven of the IBPP researchers who visited the house at some time or other agreed that there was an intelligence behind it. Its sense of timing was too good to be natural. We noticed that things would usually happen just as people were dropping off to sleep or waking up. The early morning was the usual time for furniture moving, while the bumps were mostly at night and outbreaks of fire could happen at any time, day or night. According to Irasi, the usual sequence of events would be knockings followed by dislocations of objects, and finally outbreaks of fire. Sometimes there would be total peace for days or weeks on end, and then it would all start again. There seemed to be a tendency for phenomena to be more serious in cold weather, though nights are cool most of the year in Sao Paulo, which is about 2,400 feet above sea level. Once we were satisfied that the Ipiranga poltergeist was real, we took steps to get rid of it. This is a service not always provided by researchers, but the IBPP was an all spiritist affair and regarded the welfare of its subjects as part of the job. Soon after the end of our 8-night vigil, we set about assembling a team of mediums to come to the house. This took time, and meanwhile the family, which was getting desperate, called in a local Catholic priest. The priest was an amiable fellow who came and spent about an hour talking about football before wandering around the house and waving his arms in the air without much enthusiasm. This kept Park 15 quiet for all of 3 days, after which it burned one of Nora's paranoias to ashes and set fire to the underside of the foot end of Mother's mattress for the third time and while she was asleep. Finally, The IBPP managed to get a team including four mediums together, and a prayer session was held one evening in the kitchen. I could not help being impressed by the willingness of the mediums to come to the help of a family in distress unknown to them. All four had full-time jobs, yet gave up their evening without hesitation and, I need hardly add, without a fee. The chief medium, head of the center frequented by many IBPP members, had a heavy cold and should have been home in bed. Nevertheless, she took charge of the meeting, saying she felt some hostile influence around but failing to incorporate it. She asked her spirit guides to help persuade it to leave, telling us that it might not leave at once, and might make one final defiant outburst before doing so. There was total peace for 2 weeks after this, longer than there had been for several months, but then trouble began again. It was nothing compared to what the family had been through in the past, but this time they decided they could stand it no more, and called in the Candomil Father in Sainthood, who appeared to have been mainly responsible for restoring peace to the Ruagasis boarding house. This had remained quiet for 15 months. He seemed to know what he was doing, so it seemed worth seeing if he could do whatever he did again. The man duly arrived with his heavy mob of helpers who tackle really tough cases, and for several days the family was subjected to powerful bouts of incense burning, during one of which they had to leave the house so as to be able to breathe, and assorted exhortations from the mediums. Their leader assured us that this was a particularly heavy case of black magic at work and might take some months to clear up. There was no incident for at least 3 months after the Candomil exorcism. Then, in January 1974, Irasi got married and moved out, and we heard no more from Ipiranga. We heard plenty more, however, from elsewhere in the poltergeist zone. Andrade, the spiritist scientist, Father Carlos, the Catholic professional exorcist, and the young Candomil Father in Sainthood had one view in common. They were convinced that poltergeists are the result of black magic, except where the premises rather than the people are being haunted, and in Brazil, it seems, it is invariably the people. In every single case of person-directed poltergeist activity where I have been able to study the family background, said Andrade, there has been evidence that somebody in the house could be the target of revenge from a spirit. It may be a former lover who committed suicide, a jealous relation, a spiteful neighbor, or even a member of the same family bearing some trivial grudge. Any Brazilian is well aware that this country is full of backyard terreiros of quimbanda, black magic centers, where people use spirit forces for evil purposes. You can use a knife to cut bread or to cut a man's throat, he added, and so it is with the hidden powers of the mind. They can be turned to good or bad ends, though they remain the same powers. To produce a successful poltergeist, all you need is a group of bad spirits prepared to do your work for you, for a suitable reward, and a susceptible victim who is insufficiently developed spiritually to be able to resist. Black magic is a really serious social problem in Brazil, and we must find reliable ways of getting rid of it. This is a view not widely shared in the parapsychology community, where there's much talk of exteriorized energy from the subconscious mind of the epicenter, or victim. This is, of course, a hypothesis and not an explanation, and Andrade was fond of pointing out that there was a serious flaw in it. Poltergeists are capable to expending large amounts of energy, sometimes even lifting heavy weights that no normal human could lift, yet there is never any sign of energy loss among those around whom the action takes place. Sometimes, we have seen, for months or even years. While the Ipiranga case was still active, the IBPP managed to look into two other particularly sinister cases, each of which introduced a new refinement into the art of haunting. One, which took place in the suburb of Guarulhos, is one of the strangest I have ever come across, and luckily also one of the best witnessed and documented. It is described in the next chapter. The second, in the town of Mogi das Cruzes, was nothing less than one of attempted murder. This is something poltergeists are not supposed to do, according to most authorities. Such a claim can no longer be made, for in this case not only was a house totally wrecked, but several attempts were made on the life of a baby. After narrowly escaping death by burning more than once, the baby simply disappeared after a particularly violent outburst of poltergeist activity. Hearing stifled cries coming from a basket of dirty clothing, the desperate father rushed over to find his baby entirely buried under the clothes in the process of suffocating to death. The family had to abandon the house after all the furniture had been damaged by fire and even the roof had been pounded to pieces by the furious spirit. The place looked as if a bomb had gone off inside it, and the baby, which had not yet learned even to crawl, was lucky to be alive. Cases such as this one suggest that poltergeists can be as evil in their intentions as mortals, although fortunately for us latter they seem to need certain very precise conditions in which to carry them out. Sometimes, however, their demands for such conditions are met, with fatal results. 6. The PSI Underworld. In December 1965, a respectable Catholic family in the small town of Djibouti Cabal, 220 miles from the city of São Paulo but within the borders of the state of that name, was first visited by one of the most persistently malevolent poltergeists in history. First, pieces of brick began to fall inside the house, apparently from nowhere, although there was a pile of similar bricks out in the backyard. The family decided that someone was playing tricks with them, but nobody could suggest who, or how, and the phenomena went on for several days, until it became clear that if anybody was throwing the bits of brick, it wasn't anybody visible. So the family appealed to the local priest, who duly came and went through his traditional ritual of exorcism, with much arm waving and prayer intoning. The phenomena immediately became much worse. The gravity of any formal exorcism only excites their merriment, and they treat it as of no account, says Alan Kardk, referring to what he calls disorderly spirits, or what we would now call poltergeists. The majority of them, he goes on in his usual didactic and precise style, seem to have no other object than that of amusing themselves, and to be rather reckless than wicked. Had he visited Brazil, he might have thought otherwise. Though the Djibouti Cabal family had not read Kardk, they did have a neighbor, a dentist named João Volp, who knew his Kardk very well, for he had been trained and oriented by Kerbosch Utel, one of the pioneers of the Spiritist movement in Brazil. The Catholic family turned to a Spiritist as a last resort, as they so often do. Volp came over to his neighbor's house on December 21st. He soon decided that a quiet and pretty 11-year-old named Maria José Ferrer, who was living in the house with the servants, was a natural medium and was unknowingly enabling the phenomena to take place. He immediately offered to take the girl into his own home, keep her under observation, and do what he could to treat the problem. For a few days all was quiet, but then stones began to fly around the Volp house whenever Maria José was around. The bombardment became so intense that Volp was finally able to count a total of 312 stones of all shapes and sizes, one weighing no less than 3.7 kilos. Then the disorderly spirits began to throw eggs around. They became so fond of this that before long it was impossible to keep an egg intact in the house. One day, a dozen eggs were placed on the egg rack inside the refrigerator. Out in the yard, Volp's granddaughter was feeding the chickens, when she suddenly noticed three eggs underneath one of them. This would be quite normal, except that it was a cock and not a hen, as were all the others she was feeding at the time. Back in the kitchen, it was found that there were only 9 eggs in the fridge, although nobody had opened the door. Stones kept on falling at all hours. One Sunday the Volps went to lunch with their next door neighbors. During the meal, a stone descended from the ceiling and split into two about 4 feet from the ground, the two parts proceeding in different directions as they fell to the floor. One of the women present immediately picked up the two pieces of stone and noticed that they fitted together like pieces of a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle. Moreover, they seemed to snap together as if magnetically attracted to each other. The stone was passed around the table, and everybody noticed the strange magnetic effect, which soon weakened and disappeared. Next door, at the Volp's home, Maria José was getting quite accustomed to the behavior of her unseen playmates. She found that she only had to ask them for a flower, a piece of candy or some other small object, and hey presto, it would appear at her feet. On one occasion, a stone appeared out of the air, tapped three people gently on their heads, and fell to the floor. All three people concerned stated that it was as if they had been struck by a ball of compressed air rather than a stone. This is an interesting observation. Stones thrown by poltergeists rarely hit people directly. On rare cases where physical harm has been reported, I would like to make sure the blow was not a result of a stone rebounding off a wall or other surface. Some think that the human biomagnetic field acts as a sort of defense barrier against missiles from hyperspace, while others assume that the poltergeist doesn't really want to hurt anybody, but just to attract attention the way bad-tempered children do, by flinging anything within reach as far as possible. The latter hypothesis was popular in Kardec's time, but I prefer the former. When a poltergeist really loses its temper, watch out. For a few days, nothing serious happened to or around Maria Jose. João Volpe gave her special treatment in his private study, where on two occasions stones appeared in the presence of him and a doctor colleague. One landed with considerable force on a writing desk, shattering its glass cover. Phenomena also took place in the open air. On one occasion, as Volpe and a friend were walking along the street with Maria Jose, the girl suddenly mentioned that she would like a little brooch for herself, whereupon one fell at her feet. Shortly afterwards, Maria Jose was pelted with sugar apple fruits while she was out in the yard. The fruits had been inside a bag in the house. Then stones would fall onto her plate while she was trying to eat her meals. The spirits still retained a certain sense of humor. Maria Jose was trying to pick a guava from a tree in the garden, but found she could not reach it. So she asked Mrs. Volpe to pick it for her, and as she stretched out her hand, the guava simply vanished. Then one day all hell was let loose, and for almost 3 weeks a succession of plates, glasses and even heavy flower vases was flung about the house in all directions, until the Volpes had no unbroken crockery left at all. Invisible hands began to slap Maria Jose on the face or the bottom, leaving clearly visible bruises. The spirits began to bite her all over her body. They threw chairs at her, and even a large sofa. A gas cylinder was wrenched away from the wall and hurled in her direction. Pictures jumped off walls and flew from one room to another. On one occasion, two witnesses actually saw a glass dish from the kitchen and a mirror from the bedroom cross in midair before heading for bedroom and kitchen respectively. Attempts were made to suffocate Maria Jose by forcing cups or glasses over her mouth and nose while she was asleep. There are indications that they also tried to violate her, though the poor 11-year-old's descriptions of such attempts were none too precise. Next, about 40 days after the initial outburst of brick throwing, they began to attack her with needles. It was always her left heel. Needles would simply appear thrust deep into the girl's tender flesh, even while she slept with her shoes and socks on, and sometimes even while she was out walking. On one occasion, no less than 55 needles had to be extracted at the same time. When her heel was bandaged, the bandages would be wrenched off without the knots being untied. On March 14, 1966, Maria Jose caught fire. She was eating her lunch at school when her clothing suddenly began to smolder from a round burn that had appeared as if from a cigar butt. The same afternoon, the Volpe's bedroom burst into spontaneous combustion, and while João Volpe was ripping the bedclothes off the burning mattress, he burned his hand quite badly on the pillow, which had caught fire inside, as was reported at Suzano, without his noticing. Maria Jose stayed with the long-suffering Volpes for about a year. The phenomena eased off somewhat, but never stopped altogether for long. Finally, Volpe took her to Chico Xavier's Spiritist Center in Ubraba, which serves as a kind of final court of appeal for really tough cases involving spirit possession. In front of Chico, Brazil's most respected and trustworthy medium, the obsessor came through and announced she was a witch. A lot of people suffered and I died because of her. Now we are making her suffer too. The Volpe's home circle gave the girl all the intensive treatment they could, with special prayers and appeals for help from their spirit guides in addition to repeated magnetic passes over her body. They managed to do away with the really serious attacks, such as those with needles, but the spirits refused to stop throwing things around, especially fruit and vegetables. They had come to stay.